were talking as we concluded our program yesterday, as we were reviewing just a pathetic attempt to translate Paul's letter to the Galatians in the New Living Translation. It was clear they were writing their own novel. Extraordinarily loosely based upon what Paul had written. And so we looked at their dynamic equivalents, where they said, you know, if we need to change things to help the uninitiated understand, now we'll do so. But the fact is that all of the pedantic posturing was all designed to take our attention away from the method that the New Living Translation has deployed from the beginning. It's a paraphrase. And they even say, free for clarity to catch attention. This method is normally used by an individual translator, while the other methods usually employ committees of scholars. Creativity and style are extremely important here. The translator sometimes tries to catch the attention of readers in a fresh way, seeking to jolt them and to surprise them into understanding. Well, that's all we've seen thus far from the New Living Translation, is paraphrase. Shocking. Jolting. The New Living Translation is so fresh, so jolting and surprising, it's as if that Philip Comfort and company, the Tyndale House publishers, felt as if God himself had personally inspired them to write their own Bible, leaving one fictional realm, therefore, and returning to another. We find a Nestle Allen interlinear suggesting that Paul concluded his opening statement by writing, alone, but hearing they were, that the one pursuing us then now he tells good message and trust, which then he was ravaging, and they were giving splendor in me, the God. I kid you not. This is the Nestle Allen's McReynolds Interlinear, the single most respected text there is scholastically of Paul's letter. Now, I need a paraphrase. It's not a dynamic equivalence. This is word for word. Alone but hearing they were that the one pursuing us then now he tells good message they trust, which then he was ravaging, and they were giving splendor in me, the God. If I were to render my own translation, I'm always unnerved to call it my own translation, because when you're, you know, filtering through rubbish, it's going to stink. But here is that attempt. But then from day only, mon own, they were constantly hearing that the one presently pursuing and persecuting us at various times, now he presently proclaims a healing message of faith, which once or now he was attacking and continues to annihilate. That was Galatians 1:23. And they were praising and glorifying, attributing an extremely high value and status in me for the God. Galatians 1:24. How about them apples? So what Paul is attempting to say, I would assume, excuse me for moving into the word of paraphrase, but that Paul was at least famous in his own mind for being the one that was persecuting these followers of the way. And at various times he now proclaims a healing message, but one based on faith, on beliefs, ten pistis, which once or now he was attacking and continues to annihilate. So it says that he's still a belligerent, still violent, still vicious continuing to attack and annihilate. But even though, the hell with it, they were praising and glorifying, attributing an exceptionally high status to me, Paul says, for the God. Now, why would anyone attribute a high status to an individual on behalf of God? Does God somehow benefit from somebody having status? When did God acknowledge the status of an individual? Other than to say that no individual has status or rank with God. The best we can hope for with God is to be his children. Kings hold no sway with God. Popes, no sway with God. Generals, no influence with God. But Paul wanted you to believe, if you were a Christian, that he was glorified and held value and status for the God. Well, the presentation of Poretheo to attack and to annihilate is identical to what we've seen before. By deliberately writing it in the imperfect tense, this grotesque behavior, according to Paul, was ongoing. Paul also continues to ravage and destroy. And by the way, he's writing this of himself. Glorifying me, he's writing. This is the legacy of his letters. They remain destructive and deadly as the day they were written. While it isn't currently apparent, we have been given another clue into the nature of what would become known as Pauline doctrine. This time it comes through the forced inclusion of pistis, which I have translated faith. Etymologically, the word originally conveyed an exemplary concept, trust, reliance. But that was before Paul made pistis so central to his religion that faith became synonymous with Christianity. Therefore, by alleging that his admirers equated his euangelizo beneficial message to pistis faith, Paul was setting the table for his treatise. Pistis was awkwardly tossed into the mouths of others because Paul's entire edifice will become based upon faith. It will become his alternative to the Torah. Faith. No matter how we render in emoi ton, in me for thee, and then God, there is no way to incorporate doxazo, praising and glorifying, without gagging on the result. Paul was either imagining that he had groupies who were now worshiping him, or the called out from Syria to Sicilia were collectively suffering from the Stockholm syndrome. They've been abused so long, the fact that he was only mildly abusing them on an ongoing basis caused them to think of him as wonderful now. Keeping in mind that the scenario Paul has laid out, whereby the religion of Judaism, in concert with the instructions of the chief priests, recruited and then ordered him to bludgeon Torah-observant Jews, keeping in mind that's a charade. Still, at least based upon what Paul has said about himself, it is entirely possible, perhaps probable, that the founder of the Christian faith was ruthless. By his own admission, certainly, he's ruthless. But should this be the case, it means that we are dealing with a delusional and immoral psychopath. Nonetheless, to the extent that Paul told the truth, and that he was exceptionally and uniquely vicious, in concert with his repetitive claims, then the victims of his wanton savagery may have misconstrued his apparent remission, albeit temporarily, in his brutality is somehow being praiseworthy. In such cases, victims often bond with their abuser. They see the merciless as showing signs of mercy. So in this concluding sentence, we are witnessing a psychological phenomenon that profoundly alters an individual's ability to exercise good judgment regarding those who are abusing them. And we're seeing this 19 centuries before it was codified and explained as the Stockholm Syndrome. This was not the first time, nor would it be the last, that this strategy would be deployed for nefarious means. Islam, for example, would not exist without it. Muhammad expressly authorized Muslim men to berate, to imprison, and to beat their wives, so long as they occasionally relented and showed some signs of mercy, which was usually in the form of having their way with their bodies. But if that was not sufficient to exercise complete dominion over women, then they could murder them. Doxazo, which is being directed at Paul by Paul, was translated, they were praising and glorifying, attributing an exceptionally high value and status to me. It also conveys they were considering illustrious and magnificent, holding the opinion of an especially high rank, supposing to honor, to extol, to celebrate, and to dignify Paul. Doxazo is from the base of doxa, which is to form a favorable opinion and thus to hold someone in high esteem by taking into account their behavior and reputation. And since Paul's reputation, at least according to Paul, has been that of a libertine and a terrorist, both of which in the sight of God's people would have been considered reprehensible, should this declaration have occurred, the Stockholm Syndrome provides the lone rational reason to deploy doxazo, glorifying in the opinion of the beholder in association with Paul. And since the praiseworthy connotations associated with doxazo are directed in me for God, Paul's statement can be read that the people thought highly of God in me. Paul's statement can be read that people thought highly of God in me. Now, that's extraordinarily arrogant. It places Paul in the company of the Caesars, of the emperors and the pharaohs who claimed to be God, or at the very least to represent him before men. This serves to establish Paul as co-savior and co-author, and his personal contribution of completing God's work, of something that he will acknowledge in this letter. This is yet another way in which Paul sounds like Muhammad in the Quran. You know, Paul, in the Quran, it's constantly Allah saying we. And the only way that Allah can use we is for Muhammad and Allah to be speaking collectively. Well, that's really what Paul is doing with his letters. Except his God, just like Allah, isn't really God. Now, the other options may be even worse, especially if we read this as saying, for God and me, making Paul and his God one and the same. And if God is brought into the equation and seen as part of the arrogant evaluation, then Paul rises above his God in stature, which is exactly what Satan said when he wanted to be greater than the Most High. Each of these themes will play out again in Islam, where Allah and Muhammad speak with the same voice, because Allah is Muhammad's alter ego, having demonically possessed him just as Satan had possessed Paul. And this similarity is germane to our evaluation of Paul, because in Islam, Allah is indistinguishable from Satan. They are the same personality. Same ambition, same attitude and methods. In Islam, which means the mission, Allah represents Satan. He replaces Yah as God. In Christianity, the Lord replaces Yah as God. The result is the same. The King James Version crafted a bizarre ending that serves to exacerbate the problem. It reads, "And they had heard only that he which persecuted us in times past now preaches the faith which once he destroyed, and they glorify God in me." The Latin Vulgate, from which this inappropriate ending materialized, reads similarly. "For they had only heard that he who formerly persecuted us now evangelizes the fidem faith which he once fought, and they glorify God in." Now, what's interesting here, of course, is this, whether it's these translations or Paul's original letter. He goes from speaking on behalf of the audience, you know, literally a citation, you know, that he was the one that used to persecute us. And then he turns it into first person where they said, "Then they glorify God in me." And that change in voice is abrupt. It's obvious that Paul was projecting what he wanted people to perceive of him and how they wanted people to react to him. It's all projection, all make-believe, a pretend sleight of hand with a change in voice. While typically I'm critical of these translations when they diverge from the original text, both conclusions are reasonable adaptations of Paul's poorly worded statement. It's easy to construe this as if Paul was suggesting that he and his God were equally praiseworthy. And keep in mind, the path to this place was paved with the pronouncement that Paul cannot lie. That was his previous statement. In the context of religious deceptions, it's also important to recognize that the King James rendition of the beginning of this statement was errant because the Greek word for preach, kereso, was not used, but instead euangelizo, which means to convey a healing messenger or beneficial message. And since faith is irrelevant and is the result of not knowing, when you know, faith is irrelevant, but when you do not know, it is required. How and why would it be preached? How could you preach faith? How could you preach not knowing? How could you talk to people and never provide them the information required to know and thus not to need faith? You know, faith is required when there is insufficient information to understand. So what was Paul preaching if no one understood? As I've shared, faith is required when there is insufficient information to know and thus understand. Yahweh has told us that his Torah is complete, lacking nothing. And that understanding the Torah is simple for those who are open-minded. He provides the information we need to know to understand. No faith required. Paul, however, preached faith. Now, if you're preaching faith, that means you're not providing people with sufficient information to know. That's why it is part and parcel of Pauline doctrine. Paul never presents sufficient information to grow beyond faith. This realization drives to the very heart of the great Galatians debate. It is not only out of a sense of duty that of pulling the weeds from the swamp that has become Christendom, that I continue to share the methodology of the New Living Translation with you. It reads here, "All they knew was that people were saying, the one who used to prosecute us is now preaching the very faith he tried to destroy. And they praised God because of me. Well, this isn't what Paul wrote. If this is what he was intending to say, if this is what he believed, then we should pity him. Neither Noah nor Abraham made such a claim. We do not find these words on the lips of Moshe or of Dod, David, not even Yahusha. Recamping the sixth Pauline stanza serves as a real eye-opener. The founder of the Christian religion, the author of half of the Christian New Testament, wrote, "But now I write to you, you must pay especially close attention in the presence of God, because I cannot lie. Therefore, I came to the regions of Syria and also Cilicia, but I was not known and was disregarded. I was either ignored or ignorant, not recognized or understood personally by appearance as an individual, by the called out of Yahuda in Christo. But then only they were constantly hearing that the one presently pursuing and persecuting, systematically, hastily, and intensely approaching, oppressing and harassing us at various times, now he presently proclaims a healing message of faith, which once or now at some unspecified period he was attacking and continues to annihilate. He was consistently ravaging and destroying and is devastating and overthrowing. And so they were praising and glorifying, attributing an exceptionally high value and status, considering illustrious and magnificent, holding the opinion of an especially high rank, thereby supposing to honor, to extol, to celebrate, to dignify, and to magnify me for the God." Galatians 1:20, 22, 23, and 24. Well, I was suspect that the most appropriate way to conclude this, which has now been the second chapter in questioning Paul, is to provide a review of everything that Paul has written thus far in the first chapter. It has been a rough ride to a place that most of us could not even have dared to imagine, but yet here it is. Paulos, an apostle or delegate, not separating men, not even by the means of man, but to the contrary, and emphatically on behalf of Iesu Christu and God, the Father of the one having roused and awakened him for public debate, raising him out of a dead corpse, and all of the brothers with me to the called out of Galatius, grace to you and peace from God, Father of us and Lord Iesu Christu, the one having produced and giving himself on account of the sins and errors of us, so that somehow through indefinite means he might possibly gouge or tear out, pluck or uproot us from the past circumstances and old system, which had been in place, which is disadvantageous and harmful, corrupt and worthless, malicious and malignant, extended down from and in opposition to the desire and will, the inclination and the intent of God, the Father of us. Keep in mind that old system that he is causing repugnant and disadvantageous, even harmful, that his Iesu Christu was tearing and gouging us away from, is the Torah, what Christians would call the Old Testament. To whom the assessment of the brilliant splendor, the opinion regarding the glorious radiance and appearance of the shining light, the characterization of a manifestation of God's reputation by means of the old and the new systems. Amen. Let it be so. I marvel, by the way, there is no old system, no new system. There is only one system. I marvel and am amazed and astonished, wondering and surprised, that namely in this way, quickly and in haste, you change, desert, and depart, becoming disloyal apostates and traitors away from your calling in the name of grace to a different healing message and beneficial messenger, which does not exist differently, if not conditionally or hypothetically negated, because perhaps some are the ones stirring you up. Now, they were lured, they were called apostates. They were called disloyal and traitors because they left their calling in the name of grace to a different message, which Paul says is not different, which he just called different. Oh, well, what the heck? Contradictions. Let's overlook them. Huh? Confusing you, stirring you up, but also wanting and proposing to change and pervert the beneficial messenger and healing message of the Christo, of which he never cited. But to the contrary, if we or a messenger out of heaven conveys a message or a beneficial messenger to you, which is approximate or contrary to, beyond or positioned alongside what we have delivered as a beneficial messenger and announced as a healing message to you, then a curse with a dreadful consequence exists. Don't you even dare challenge what I say. As we have already said and just now say, immediately thereafter, repetitively, I say, if under the condition someone delivers a helpful messenger or communicates a useful message to you, contrary or in opposition to, close or approximate to, even greater than what you received, it shall be, in fact, I command and want it to exist as a curse with a dreadful consequence. For because currently and simultaneously men I persuade, I presently and actually use words to win the favor of seducing, misleading, coaxing, conniving, and placating, or alternatively, the God. Or by comparison and contrast, I seek and desire to please, to accommodate humans. Yet nevertheless, if men I was pleasing and accommodating, exciting the emotions and lifting up as a slave of Christu, certainly was not me. So he's trying to tell you here that, you know, you can decide. Am I trying to appease and placate, to seduce and mislead God or men? You choose. I don't care which one you choose, quite frankly. If you think that Paul was trying to persuade, seduce, mislead, or placate God or men, makes no difference. Either way, it's wrong. But nevertheless, I profess and reveal to you of the beneficial message which has been communicated advantageously by and through myself, because it is not in accord with man. But neither because by man associating myself with it, nor was I taught or instructed as a disciple, but to the contrary, by way of a revelation, an appearance serving to uncover and unveil Iesu Christu. Of course, Yosha said, if someone makes that claim, don't believe them. For because indeed you heard of my wayward behavior in some time and place in the practice of Judaism, namely that because throughout showing superiority surpassing any measure of restraint, and to an extraordinary degree, and better than anyone else, I was aggressively and intensely pursuing, persecuting, oppressing, and harassing the called out of God. And I was devastating her, continuing to undermine and annihilate them. Okay. So here is Paul claiming that he was the best all-time practitioner of the Jewish religion, and that's what made him ruthless. No, that would not be true. And so I was and continued to progress, accomplishing a great deal. And I persist moving forward in the practice of Judaism over and above many of my contemporaries among my race, excessively and overabundantly enthusiastic, devoted, burning with passion to belong to the traditions and teachings handed down by my forefathers. Notice he didn't say excited, burning with passion to be guided by Yahweh's Torah. No, he was religious, persisting, abundantly enthusiastic about their traditions handed down by my forefathers. That's the oral law. That's the Talmud. That's what Paul loved. But at that point in time when it pleased and was chosen enjoyable and better for God, the one having appointed me, setting me aside out of the womb of my mother. We'll return to this malarkey in a moment. We're reviewing the entirety of Paul's first chapter, his inaugural chapter of his inaugural letter. And he had the audacity to say, but at a point in time when it pleased and was chosen enjoyable and better for God, the one having appointed me, setting me aside out of my mother's womb, to reveal and disclose, uncovering and unveiling the Son of Him in order that I could announce the healing message among the races immediately. I did not ask the advice or consult with flesh and blood. Yeah. You know, if you believe this, shame on you. If you believe that any of this is true, then you deserve your fate. I did not ascend to Jerusalem toward the goal of being with or against the apostles before me, but to the contrary, I went away, withdrawing to Arabia, and returned again to Damascus. Then later in the sequence of events, after 3 years' time, I ascended up to Jerusalem to visit and get acquainted with Kephas, and remained against or with him, depending on how you translate the word, for 15 days. But other of the apostles I did not see, I did not pay attention to or concern myself with, except Jacob, the brother of the Lord. But now I write to you, you must pay especially close attention in the presence of God, because I cannot lie. That's all this boy has done. Thereafter, I came to the regions of Syria and also Cilicia. But I was not known, and I was disregarded. I was either ignored or ignorant, was not recognized or understood personally by appearance as an individual by the call out of Yahudah in Christo. But then, only they were constantly hearing that the one presently pursuing and persecuting, systematically, hastily, and intensely approaching and oppressing, as well as harassing us at various times, now he presently proclaims a healing message of faith, which once or now at some unspecified period he was attacking and continues to annihilate. He was consistently ravaging and destroying, and he is devastating, even overthrowing. And so they were praising and glorifying, attributing exceptionally high value and status, considering illustrious and magnificent, holding the opinion of an especially high rank, supposing to honor, extol, celebrate, dignify, and magnify in me for the God. This is so preposterous. So egotistical. It's spellbinding. I mean, it's hard to imagine even Satan writing such vile words. And yet, this is what his messenger wrote. It is what Christians believe. This is the basis of half of their New Testament. Is it little wonder that the only person Yahweh spoke about prophetically by name to warn us about, to call the plague of death, to denounce his circular reasoning, his gargantuan ego, and his message that would leave everyone wanting, was Paul, calling him the plague of death? I don't think we should be surprised. The most infamous man in human history, the man who has done the most harm of all who have ever lived, is this man, Paul. No one. Not even Hadrian. Not even Vespasian. Not even Nero or Claudius. Not even Caligula. Have harmed humanity as much as this man. Not Muhammad. Not Adolf Hitler. No, the worst man who ever lived is the man who authored these words. He was the one man that God took the time through his prophet Habakkuk to call out by name, that said that he would come during the fulfillment of the Moed, which is when he arrived in Jerusalem, that he would speak to the races, to Gentiles, that he would use circular reasoning, that he would be egotistical beyond imagination, and that he would be the plague of death. And yet so very few people listen to God, preferring instead to be bewildered by this demonic influence.